I don't know about you if you've ever had weeks where you're just kind of either full of stress or it's just been a tough day or whatever, and the idea of anybody having fun just annoys the heck out of you. Have you had, do you know, I assume that your laughter means that you can relate to some of that. You know what I mean, though, right? I have days, this can particularly be true with my children, I have days where I'll come home after maybe a tough conversation on the phone or a particularly intense emotional day, and my kids are like wrestling in the middle of the living room. And they're just, they're goofing around and laughing, and they're not breaking anything. Nobody's getting hurt, you know. But I'll be like, you know, like, cut that out, guys. Come on, fun is forbidden in this house. And I tend to be a pretty lighthearted guy, but I have a lot of moments where that's just my kind of gut feeling. But I've been wondering, you know, over the course of the church's history, that's kind of been a lot of the attitude. Fun is forbidden. But I guess I would wonder what seems more sinful in that moment? What seems further from the mark of God? My comment or my children wrestling? Throwing a ball around and even knocking a lamp over? Or me getting so upset that I can't see what they were trying to do in the first place? What's maybe missing the mark more? 3 years ago, I was on a trip with my kids, and I was in grumpy dad drill sergeant travel mode because we were at a rest stop, and I have a steel bladder, so I can go 6 hours easily on the road and not have to stop and pee. My children and my wife, only one, my daughter, she takes after me, but nobody else. Sorry, this is like too much information, right? But so we need to stop, and I'm like, oh, I don't even remember where we were going. It was one of those rest stops in the middle of the winter. I think we were coming back from a retreat I was speaking at, and I just had this attitude, and the kids, you know, they've been cooped up in the van, and they go out, and there's snow on the edges of the sidewalk, and they start kicking at it and I went into that mode of like, will you guys not, don't touch the snow. We don't want to get, you know, wet stuff in the van. It was a cold day. It wasn't even slushy. And for some reason, something just kind of sparked in me, and I stopped. And my kids were up ahead of me, and I took a step back, and I looked at the snow, and I picked up the snow, and I looked at my son, and I fired a snowball at him, and I hit him in the back of the shoulder. And he turned around, and at this rest stop in the middle of a long trip, and my wife caught the picture. I think I was throwing at her because she was trying to take a picture of this. But anyways, there was just this moment. And as soon as I started that, there was this joy that all of a sudden I realized, what is the worst that can happen in this situation? That a little bit of snow gets in our van. This is the worst that can happen in this situation. And instead, what we had was this laughter and fun and this raucous time. And it was a turning point mentally for me that I go back to frequently. And the reason I go back to it is because there's something that it tapped into that we tend to lose as we get older. So this is the final week that we're having a conversation about questions that children ask that adults don't, and what it means for us to look to the scriptures and see Jesus illuminating things and areas where we may somehow forget what it means to live well in the world because we've adulted a little bit too much. And so what we're going to chat about this morning a little bit is the question, and we talked about, will you be my friend, about what it means to have meaningful friendships that are founded around Jesus and the way of Jesus and authenticity and vulnerability. And then Dwayne dug into vulnerability even more last week with the question of, will you help me, which kids ask. And so this week, we're asking the question, will you play with me? And that's a question that children tend to ask that adults have maybe lost sight of frequently. And I think that there's something really beautiful that we may be able to tap into. When we are children, we have one job, and that job is to play and play hard, right? Play like your life depends on it. When we get older, we sense that that's kind of a little bit juvenile. And so what we end up doing is we have lives and we have responsibilities, and our job is now our job. That's our job. Our job used to be play, but now our job is our job, right? And the older we get, the more we tend to lose our sense of play. This is true in every single Christmas movie ever made, right? like every Christmas movie ever made is about some usually a guy that has super grumpy and lost the ability, lost any spirit of playfulness. And the whole thing about the Christmas spirit is finally he sings, he joins in singing, or he is kind to his child or something like that. Something, it's like really, really bad person, like it's completely, but part of the solution is that they rediscover joy, laughter, a sense of play. So the question is, how important is play, and what is it in the role? What role does it play in the life of a Jesus person? And in what sort of a way could it affect our interpersonal relationships with each other? So what we're going to start by looking at God, because our view of God is crucial. How we view and understand God affects everything. It affects how we interact with each other. It affects how we understand our worth in sight of God. And so how we, when you close your eyes, how you picture God, the facial expression that you picture God having, the posture that you picture God having, all of these things, and it's really important that we actually have images of that. Otherwise, we just have words. Words are not terribly helpful in defining God. But if we get images, that's what sticks with us. We know this from all this sort of cognitive development stuff. So when you picture God, what kind of a posture, what kind of a facial expression does God have? And what do the scriptures reveal? So the big question that we want to start with is God playful? I want to make a case, shocker, that I believe, yeah. I believe that the scriptures reveal that there is a playfulness within the character of God. And the way that we kind of can look at that is in a whole bunch of ways, but even from the beginning, in the story of Genesis 1, we get this image of God creating and then looking and noticing that it's good. That word is connected, tov, is connected with delight. Notices something is worthy of enjoyment. Okay, and so he looks and God creates light and he sees that it's good. And he creates land and sea and he sees that it's good. And then he creates plants and he sees that they are good. And then the sun and the moon, they're good. And the fish and the birds, they're good. Over and over. All the animals, they are good. And then he creates people and he steps back and he looks at things. He said, this is very, very, very good. God is having a good time with creation. We can't get into this today, but if you back that up and against all of the ancient Babylonian creation myths that exist, where the foundation of the earth and the foundation of the world is all based on the gods going to war with one another and slaying each other, and one of the bodies of the gods falls, and that creates the earth, and the blood creates the oceans and everything like that, we get a God who playfully and intentionally with joy creates the world. So we get a sense maybe that God delights in his creation. Psalm 104 is a great kind of glimpse into this. The psalmist is kind of waxing about God's creation. Here is the ocean vast and wide, teeming with life of every kind, both large and small. See the ships sailing along and Leviathan, which you made to play in the sea. Which you made to play in the sea. He talks about the sea creatures. You made them to play. That's the image that the psalmist gets when he imagines God. And then just a few verses later, he says this, may the glory of the Lord continue forever. The Lord takes pleasure. The Lord takes pleasure in all he has made. God takes pleasure in what he's made. So there's this idea that God is playful and delights in his creation. And then there seems to be all these expressions of humor in the Bible. If you've noticed, there's a story in Numbers 22 about a guy named Balaam, and he has a donkey. And this angel appears, and Balaam can't see him, but his donkey can. And his donkey keeps, like, bucking away from the angel, okay? And Balaam keeps beating the donkey every time he does so. He's had this donkey for a really long time. And so it happens, like, three times. And finally, the donkey turns on him. He's like, what are you doing? Why do you keep beating me? And Balaam, like, is like, ironically, he continues the argument. He doesn't say, how are you talking? What he says is, well, you're not listening. And he's like, have I ever been disobedient to you before? And when he realizes that the answer is no, he sees this angel and he kind of apologizes. But I heard a pastor say that God once spoke through Balaam's ass and he's been using them to communicate ever since. But we have this idea of almost humor of God. In Matthew 17, Jesus is asked about the temple tax with Peter. And what he ends up doing after he answers the question is he sends him to go fishing. And he says, you're going to find a fish with a coin in its mouth. Go ahead and use that to pay the tax. Essentially saying, that's not my world. But yeah, let's humor them. We'll pay their taxes and just go and find a fish. That's like the equivalent, right, of a of a magician pulling a coin out of a kid's ear. Kids love that, right? There's a playfulness about it. Jesus is having fun. He could have just, you know, if he was going to bring the coin from the fish, he could have brought it from his back pocket too. There's humor there. There's supposed to be something. How about the Emmaus Road incident in John 20, or in Luke 24? Jesus is, after the resurrection, God somehow keeps him from being revealed, and he joins two men who are talking about things, and he says, you know, hey, what's been going on lately this weekend? And they look at him like, what, do you live under a rock? You didn't hear about all of this? This Jesus character that was a strong prophet and all this, but we don't know what's happened, and Jesus reveals all this stuff to them. And so they listen to him as he unpacks the scriptures all about him, and then they beg him to stay with him overnight. And so what happens is he sits down with them to eat dinner, and when he breaks the bread, I love it, when he breaks the bread, all of a sudden their eyes are open and he vanishes. And you can just imagine Jesus being like, did you see their faces? That was awesome, you know? And all of a sudden all this stuff, we have to somehow sometimes take a little step back and say, wow, there is so much beauty and there's almost a playfulness in how God chooses to reveal God's self throughout the scriptures. And then we have the idea that at our core, we are playful. Animals are playful, right? This is why we have cat videos, right? I mean, isn't that true? Like animals have this playful spirit about them. And so we have two choices. Either the playfulness of ourselves at our nature and the playfulness of animals in the world, they are either a result of God's imprint on us or they are a result of our fallen character. We have to, it's one of the two, because it's inherent in us, it's inherent in creation, there's a playfulness. So it's either God's mark in us, God's creative genius in the world, or it's a part of how we are selfish, sinful people. What do you think? I think it's the mark of the Creator. And of course, Jesus was a partier. And I say that, and you can roll your eyes rightly so because of a phrase like that. But here's the thing. What we notice is there's this passage, and that's not it. Let's see if I can find it. Oh, okay, I'll read it to you. For some reason, it's not showing up. It's probably in there somewhere. But there's this passage in Matthew 11, and Jesus is known as a friend of tax collectors and sinners. And we need to lean into this before we go into the next part. The reason that Jesus was known as a friend of tax collectors and sinners is because he hung out with them. And now, a rabbi would frequently teach anybody who wanted to listen when they were doing open-air teaching, sitting on hillsides, stuff like that. It would not be strange that a rabbi would be speaking and there would be tax collectors or prostitutes or whatever in the crowd. That wouldn't be radical. What was radical was Jesus hung out with them regularly. So when we get in our mind, well, yeah, but he had this agenda where he was telling them how to live right. Not the whole time. We cannot possibly get away from the fact that Jesus went and he partied with the partiers. And that is why he was labeled what he was. It wasn't just that he associated with them, it was that he actually had friends with people who were raucous, crazy people. And so in Matthew 11, we get this story, and people look at him, and Jesus is saying, you'll never get it to some of the Pharisees. He said, for John the Baptist came neither drinking nor eating, and they said he has a demon. And the Son of Man comes eating and drinking, and they say, here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So in other words, I'm never going to please you, or God's people will never please you, no matter in what form they come. But then he says this, but wisdom is proved right by her deeds. Wisdom is proved right by her deeds. So a phrase like that, wisdom is proved right by her deeds, essentially means, right, the results will prove what's true. The results that you see at the end of this life, the results that you see of whatever, it's going to prove what's true or not. But Jesus uses this word, wisdom will be proved right by her deeds. That's the he uses this personification of the word wisdom. Okay? There's another place in the scriptures where wisdom is personified, and it's in the Proverbs. And wisdom is personified in the Proverbs, specifically in chapter 8, as this A lot of scholars think that it's a connection to the Holy Spirit. Wisdom is personified as one who she was present. It's the word Holy Spirit is actually a feminine word in the Hebrew. In Greek, pneuma is a neuter word, so it doesn't have a connotation. But in the Old Testament, the word for spirit actually has a feminine connotation. So does wisdom. And so wisdom, she was there and present at the foundation of the world. For all of it. And there's this ongoing kind of explanation of, while the world was being created, I was a part of it. I was watching before the foundations of the earth, it says in Proverbs. And before you read this, let me read the rest of the little passage, if I have it here. Actually, let's just read this because I just realized we got to keep moving. But okay, before the mountains were settled into place and before the hills, I was brought forth, wisdom says. This is verse 25 as we lead up to this. While as yet the earth and the fields were not made, nor the first clods of the world, when he established the heavens, I was there. When he marked out the vault over the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he fixed fast the foundations of the earth. And I was his delight day by day, playing before him all the while, playing on the surface of his earth, and I found delight in the sons of men. That's a literal translation from one of the more literal translations. Jesus says wisdom is proven right by her actions when he is accused of being a partier. And he uses a personification of wisdom that is found elsewhere in the Old Testament, in his Bible, that people would have been familiar with. And the personification of what wisdom does, what are wisdom's actions? Wisdom's a dancer. Wisdom delights in people. Wisdom plays on the surface of God's earth. This is what we get. So when Jesus says wisdom is proven right by our actions, I believe he's actually doing a double meaning there. What are the actions of wisdom? She was playful. She knew that part of this world, part of the reality of life, was about vibrancy and play and dancing. And watch, the Son of Man, who you think probably dances a little too much, probably parties a little too much, you will see where wisdom emerges through what the actions eventually are. So all of that, I believe that when we learn to play, we actually express God's nature. We also enact a vision of the day when we'll be fully restored. In Zechariah 8, as God's people are dispersed and they're longing for the day that one day everything will be restored, part of the vision is that once again, men and women of ripe old age will sit on the streets of Jerusalem, each of them with a cane in their hand because of their age. That means that they will not die young because of war and violence and displacement. And the city streets will be filled with boys and girls playing there. This is an image. Playfulness is an image of God's hope that the world is being set right. So when we learn how to play with one another in healthy, beautiful ways, what that does is it enacts a vision of wholeness and shalom. And so we have to learn, what does this look like for us? In a second, I'm going to bring Mark and Melissa up because they have some play rhythms that have been really, really neat to watch over the last couple years with others. So now the goal was just to establish that play is indeed a part of God's character, and therefore when we play, we express God's character and we can delight in God. But the second thing then is, what happens when we actually play with others? Silliness has a way of leading us into vulnerability, doesn't it? Just think about that for a second. Silliness has a way of leading us into vulnerability. We've been talking about vulnerability so much over the past weeks. But laughing can actually set up the seriousness. If you've ever listened to a really brilliant communicator, one of the things that you'll notice is that you're laughing one minute and you're crying the next. Is that just because they're really good at manipulating your emotions? Possibly. But it could also mean something else. And what that means is that when we laugh, when we play, when we can be lighthearted, something in us opens up that allows us to receive significance at a different level. It allows us to receive the serious because we've walked through the silly. There's something that's been built in that process. Something softens. When we laugh at ourselves, even in the midst of pain, we break down these barriers and we make it safe for other people to do the same. A couple of months ago, I was sitting in Mexico on a learning tour, and I was sitting with individuals who had who had crossed the border illegally and then been returned to Mexico, and we were learning about the economic situation and about what migrants face and about both how complicated this whole situation is, but also what does compassion look like to people who are really desperate. And so we went and we toured migrant shelters and we listened to a lot of presentations. But one evening, we went to Alonzo's house and we just had dinner. And he and his wife had settled down and found meaningful income and stuff. But they told us, one of the interesting things about being with them is that when we sat with them, 15 of us piled into this tiny little Mexican house with their one child and their dog, who was named Big Ears because he had massive ears. So they named him Big Ears. Big Ears, get over here, in Spanish. But so we were working through translator the whole time, because only a couple of us were fluent in Spanish. And instead of just saying, well, here's our story, they told us, they told us funny story after funny story about their lives and about how delightful, how many good things happened. But one of the things that they said was, they talked about how she said that she had locked her keys. She had left her keys in the house behind the gate in their little front yard, and she left, and then she forgot something, and she realized she couldn't get back in, so she climbed up the gate, and she was 5 feet off the ground, and she got stuck, and so she called her friend, and her friend came, and instead of helping her, her friend opened her phone and started Facebook Living her on top of this fence, freaking out, and we're all laughing, and it's raucous. Here are people who have gone through unimaginable difficulty in their lives, and they're laughing, and we're all of a sudden, and it's raucous. I mean, like they're jumping around and dancing, and then the story comes later where we talk about how he was arrested and detained for 2 years, and when it came time for him to actually be returned to Mexico, they called his name. He gave everything away, his bed sheets, everything that he had collected during this time to other people who were still being detained. He walked down the hallway. He found out that they had the wrong name, and it was going to be 2 more weeks. He had nothing left. He walked back to his room, but by that time, his bottom bunk and everything he had been taken, and he's telling us this story, and then he points up and he goes, but the real problem was that I was on the top bunk, and we were in America, and we're looking at him, and he's like, I'm Mexican. And he's like, I had to jump to climb up to my bunk every night because I'm so short. And everybody just started to crack up. And he was laughing and welcoming us in to deep places. But laughter somehow was the way that we were able to actually access some of the depth of the conversation. And we walked away having laughed more than we laughed any other time in the trip, but also feeling a deeper connection than we had felt to any single person throughout the trip. And there's something about what laughter does, what play does, that teaches us about that. Something that very few other things can accomplish. Ecclesiastes says there's a time for laughing and there's a time for weeping. And it's interesting that those are in the same sentence. And it might not just be because they're on opposite ends of the spectrum. It might be because they're connected. Mark and Melissa, come on up. So, we only have one. All right. We'll just stand. I was gonna grab another stool, but I forgot. There's one mic. So just as you come up, I just want to remind you that a number of years ago, here you go, that a number of years ago, the Puritans made this declaration. It is ordered that all persons whatsoever that have cards, dice, or tables in their houses shall make away with them before the next court under pain of punishment. And this was because of the orders that they had received from God. So, let's talk about what you guys like to do with your game nights.
We don't do game nights, actually.
Don't call the police.
All right. So, you guys for years have just had a blast with hosting and facilitating game nights and other sorts of fun experiences. And so the question is, what have you done and what's the impact of some of those game nights been?
Okay. So we have game nights, sometimes a lot, sometimes it's few and far between. And we try to invite a mix of people, and it's really simple. Like, it's not a big deal. We have a pile of games and we have some food, usually popcorn or a bag of chips because it's easy. And so that's what we do. Like, I feel silly even explaining that. Sorry. So, but the impact has been interesting to see that there are connections made around a table playing Oregon Trail or whatever. This is very important. You don't diss Terry. But it's this relaxed attitude and relaxed nature. Well, as relaxed as you can be while being killed or the world falling apart or dying of dysentery, that you can't get in any other way. You know, we're just sitting there, we're playing games, we're laughing, we're talking. And I
think how is it different than if you would just be sharing dinner? Is it?
It is, for sure. Did you want to talk about this?
Yeah. Elisa mentioned last week, I don't think I was there, but she said something like eating like a truck driver, something
no,
like.
No, not Elisa, Elise.
Oh, Elise, a friend of yours. Oh, I thought it was this Elisa. Sorry.
Different person.
Miscommunication. We're really good.
Elisa does not eat like a truck driver. My yes. friend Elise.
Yes, that's what it was, sir.
Unless it's tacos which. Yes.
But, you know, for eating dinner, like, I eat like a truck driver because I was raised by a truck driver. So, would literally just shovel it down and like, all right, we're done. We talked a little bit. Let's clean up dishes. I'm good at cleaning up dishes. That's generally my job. So it's not something that, and we even talked about a little bit, that sitting down to dinner can even be like anxiety producing because you don't know what to talk about or, you know, the kids are doing this. And like, it can just be not as relaxing.
And what do I make?
Yeah, and what do I make?
There's
what do
food
I bring? And yes,
so
many things about it. But then when we sit down for a game, it's like, okay, this is the thing we're doing. It's the content. It's the it's the facilitator of what's going to happen. And so as we get that going, everybody kind of settles in a little bit and gets comfortable with, okay, this is my role. This is what I do. This is, you know, we're all working in this together on a cooperative, whatever it might be.
Do you think that the idea of the fact that eating, and we love sharing meals, by the way, we obviously, we have meal communities that as the
good.
Foundation
yes.
of our church. But is there something, like eating is something everybody has to do.
Yes.
But choosing to do a game is a complete choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complete non-necessity.
Right.
And when we do something that is a complete non-necessity, we tap into something different than the driven brain approaches often.
Yeah, it becomes more of a break, I find. Like, okay, now we're sitting down and it's the time of the day where we're not rushing to the next thing. I said that I was working on being still because I am not good at being still. I am like the hamster on the wheel. But, like, we have to sit here and play this game for 60 minutes because it's a 60-minute game. Like, you are done. Like, this is what we're doing. And we're all together. And it just opens up this time. Like Mark said, if you eat and you're done, then you're done. And you're just, what now? Mm-hmm. And especially for the more introverted types, that's scary. Because the food's done, and now you're going to want to talk to me, and I'm on the spot, and everyone's looking at me, and this, because I'm the guest here, and that is not comfortable. But if you can, quote unquote, hide or have like a little safety net of a hand of cards or the marbles around the board.
Or a sport, right? We
or
could
a
take
sport.
This much
better. Yeah, it can go, like, I'm not sporty, so I like the board games. But yeah, you have this other thing that it's a little bit, I don't like a barrier in a good way. Like it's a safety net. Like if I don't feel comfortable right away, I have this thing to do and that can let people ease in. Not everybody is extroverted and dives in.
So what have the two of you seen in terms of why do you think that this idea of learning how to play and have really legitimately intentional, lighthearted times together is important in Jesus-centered relationships or in helping to move toward Jesus-centered relationships with other people? What doors have you seen open?
It's funny, because, I mean, you people, probably most of you have met me, and if you haven't yet, I'll catch you on the way out.
You can't last long in our church without meeting Mark.
And so most everybody knows Mark as the guy that will just talk to you and, like, I don't know, I'm just a lighthearted, chatty kind of guy. But I feel like the games has created opportunities for relationships that before playing games are kind of shallower. And then when you have that time of just sitting there sharing, and then we have certain games where, like, okay, everybody just kind of puts down their cards and we have a whole long conversation. And then we resume the game midway through.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that game's not nearly as important as what kind of the topic that came up. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, the relationships that have happened are people that we'll never see here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've we've asked and offered, and you know, and not in like a beating them over the head kind of way, but like, hey, we have this thing going on, or your kid asked about this the other day. Do y'all want to come to like Christmas service and not have them talking about Jesus's blood because he gets kind of freaked out about that?
Right.
You know, like the conversations can come, and we can have real significant conversations. And I'm not the best at like looking for the angle on introvert, you know, introducing a spiritual conversation into one that's maybe not, but the opportunities continue to come up, and I'm just pleased because there are people that, you know, through we met through theater, just random other connections that we have because we meet a lot of people. But I mean, they just come and they're welcome and they feel comfortable there where they wouldn't, you know, in a formal setting, something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it breaks down that barrier between us and them. And unfortunately, we have a PR problem as Christians in some areas. I mean, that's just unfortunately the way it is. And so when you encounter somebody who maybe has been hurt or has a bad idea of what a Christian is or looks like, but you sit down and you play a game, it breaks that down to where they see, okay, we have a lot more commonality than I thought we had. Like, there's more here. And then when you have that basis of a relationship of, I like you. I like sitting here and playing this game with you. I'm willing to open up an hour of my busy life to let you in. That opens up worlds of connection that love can then come in. And there can't be a drawing into Jesus without that love. That's the basis.
An openness.
Yeah, and when you think about what you talked about, how Christ followers have a PR problem, and what one of the things that that people are quick to think of when they think of a stereotypical Christian is they're not any fun and they're judging me. We know statistically. You might say, well, that's not true. Well, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. That's what the attitude is, the prevailing ethos in so many people.
Yeah.
And so when we are able to have fun with people, number one, when we're joking around, when we're playing a game, it's very, very difficult to feel judged.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we can show that, no, we can just be together and enjoy time, which I am convinced Jesus did a ton of. I'm convinced that Jesus was not at every dinner teaching people why you need to be better. I'm convinced that came because they sensed a love so strong, so caring for them and open, that they said, I want to know what your message is. I want to know what you're about, because I feel loved in a way that I have never felt loved and cared about before. And that opens the door to transformation.
And just even amongst Jesus followers, like, it doesn't have to be a missional thing, like, because sometimes that can be very scary. Like, I don't know what to do.
Our friends that go to like a church that has like, you know, King James only, like really traditional, they call us, what they say, something like Black Ops of Christianity or something like that. She goes into the theater and meets all the people that would not generally, you know, expect to see in a church.
Oh, that's great.
So, like, it's a cool thing, but like that idea that we are, you know, going and reaching these people that are not Christians, but then the people that are Christians that show up at our house have a great time and have a connection that normally is hard to get. So.
Right. I mean, because, I mean, I'm going to try not to go too scientific, but there's things that happen in your brain when you're having fun. When you are having fun with someone and dopamine is released.
Yeah, it's a bonding, right?
It's bonding. Yeah. It's just, that's why I'm convinced that's why they say, like, college is the best time of your life, because you're having fun, right? I mean, most of the time. I do not ever want to do finals again. But, like, there are fun times to be had, and those are your friends because you've had these bonding experiences. And that doesn't have to end just because now you're 20s or 30s and you have a job and you have bills and all of that. Like, we can still have those moments and those connections that are made because we're laughing. I can't tell you how many times that somebody has stayed late after everyone has gone and has felt comfortable talking about a situation. And it's because those moments of connection, I mean, I won't nerd out too much, but there's a scientific basis to laughing with people that you wouldn't get at a Bible study. Now, Bible studies are great. I'm not dissing that. Or Terry.
Well done. That was nice. That was excellent.
Thank you very much. Whew. Brought it back. But it's just a different situation. It's not the same bonding that would happen over mm-hmm. a game yeah. or yeah. volleyball right. for you people.
Good stuff. Well, thanks you two yeah. for giving us some insight into your rhythm. And it can look so different. Yeah. It can look so different for everybody, but the point being is sometimes we take ourselves far too seriously. Sometimes we take life far too seriously, and we don't think that this is a valuable time. It's if I have time, I will give space to laughter and fun, but I've just been so busy lately. This is a part of God's nature that we tend to push away, and it's an opportunity for us to reveal the love of Christ. So the learning to play the right way, I want to encourage you on two things, or two questions to ask. The first one is, does this form of play, whatever you might think of it, does it help me delight in God? Is there something about it that when you do it, it helps you delight in God? Okay, so that's one question to ask you when you're thinking about what are the types of play that might actually be connecting me to that image and that imprint? And then the second question is, does it connect me in valuable ways to others, or does it push me away from them? So delighting in God, and does it connect me to others in meaningful ways? You might want to play basketball at the Y, but if every single time you go, you spend all of your time frustrated and angry anytime that you're losing and like calling fouls on people and getting super ticked off, it's probably not actually connecting you to others in a meaningful way. So you need to find a different activity, or you need to change your approach to it. So what types of play connect us to God? Like, oh, I love, I'm a runner. And when I play by running on trails, I feel so connected to God, it's unbelievable. Now, that doesn't connect me to others. So I want to do some things that also connect me to others and figure out, you know, and I love barbecues and I love playing cornhole and stuff like that. So what does it look like to think and ask those two questions? I have to just say, some of you are present on Christmas Eve, and we have this informal rhythm where at the end of our Christmas Eve services every year, we have a snowball fight in this room that with fake snowballs that breaks out at the end of High and Holy Silent Night, and then a huge snowball fight. And some of you guys, you know, you're getting up there in years, but you can still hurl a snowball, and I've seen it, and I've seen the smiles and the joy on your faces as you do. We all have that playful spirit, and that's some of, I don't believe that's disconnected from what God does when we gather to celebrate Christmas Eve. I think it's all part of it, so be open to it. Your takeaway, maybe, I want you to think about one way that you want to be more playful with other people, and then move on it this week, okay? One way that you want to be more playful, schedule something, invite somebody to join you for something, learn a new skill that you're terrible at that makes you laugh, though. That's fun to learn. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing terribly. It's part of freedom in Christ. So what is one way that you can move forward in play? Okay? Here's the questions. We're not going to do Q&A today. We typically do, but we had a bunch of other sharing. So this is just takeaways for your meal communities or for your triad groups or your friends. What barriers have you seen or experienced that hinder the ability of adults to be playful? Think about that question. And where have you seen God open doors through what I call the discipline of play? Because sometimes it feels like I have to actually schedule this. But where have you already seen God open doors? So what barriers might you have to get past? And then look back and say, wow, God really opened a door through that time and season when I was able to lean into that. We're going to move into communion in just a moment. But I want to leave you. We've taken 3 weeks to talk about this whole idea of what it means to ask questions that kids ask, but we don't. So I want to end by sharing this quote from G.K. Chesterton that I think is really, really helpful for us. So just listen to it carefully. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again, right? Throw your kid up, do it again, do it again. And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-ups are not strong enough to exalt in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exalt in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun. And every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy for we have sinned and grown old, and our father is younger than we. Embrace the beauty of what children around us teach us. We have a ton of kids in our church. Embrace the beauty of what they bring and reveal to us. As Jesus said, the kingdom is intended for people like these. Let's pray. Lord, we've become too serious too much. And sometimes we've lost the ability to play well, to delight, to laugh. I pray that we might be so deeply in touch with your spirit that we might learn how to dance again, that we might learn how to be free, that we might learn how to invite people in to our lives, because sometimes our family are the only people that ever get to see this side of us. I pray that you would help us invite others in to our play, that we might break down barriers between each other and barriers to you, Lord. Give us strength and insight in how we take what we're thinking about this morning and move forward to extend your kingdom of love in our lives. We ask all of this together in the strong name of Jesus, saying, Amen.